Righteous anger can be useful if applied to the right people. Welcome everyone here to another episode of the Mere Mortals Book Reviews. I'm your host Kyron, and this is the podcast, as you might surmise, where I talk about my inner womanly voice. Okay, perhaps not. Or perhaps maybe we will, right at the end, because we do have Virginia Woolf's A Room of One's Own, which is a classic piece of feminist literature. This book is 93 pages in length, published in 1929. I'd say it took me about 3 hours of reading to get through. It's relatively dense on the page, and her wording itself is a little bit dense, so I think it takes a little bit longer to read. You have to kind of like slow down. It's not something you go through really quickly. What this is an essay of 6 chapters directed at an audience of women for a speech that she was doing in some sort of college in London, like King's College, I can't remember. And the topic was women and fiction. So she kind of just was sort of freeballing. This is kind of her style, this stream of consciousness. So it's a mix of observations about London and, you know, about women on the campus and what she can and can't do. This mix about reading history of being in the library and going through all of these books of the kind of like history of, okay, here's some woman writers, here's some male writers, what do they say about women writing and things like this. And then finally, we have just, I would say, a bunch of her observations, recommendations, books that she's read and things like this. So it's, as I mentioned, 93 pages. It's not super long, so there's not that much to cover into it, which will get us straight into the themes. Obviously, it is all centered around women and fiction. So I'm going to split this into 2 sections. The first, it'll be, I suppose, some of the rational type arguments that she makes in this essay and in her speech. And this is a speech that was condensed down as well. So it's not the full speech. And I believe it was 2 speeches that she published, that she did in 1928, and then were later published as book form. And then I'll talk about perhaps some of the more emotional points that we came to. The first is the rational. And I think she makes some pretty good arguments and posits some pretty decent questions as well. So for example, how can you measure an occupation's worth? And remember, this was back in 1929. Women had, by and large, not entered the workforce en masse yet. That was probably more to come during the kind of like World War II era, where everyone needed to work. And so this was kind of like a question she posits, because she was basically saying like, hey, how could we measure how much value a stay-at-home wife is providing compared to a man who makes a salary? And obviously a woman who's staying at home looking after the children, she's doing a job. Like it's definitely a job. It's one which perhaps has some benefits and some pleasures, but it also requires like a lot of tedious crap of cleaning things, cooking things, you know, caring after children, making sure the house is functioning, all these sorts of things. And a lot of the, I guess, stigma, I guess, at the time, or just the perception at the time was, you know, this is like the woman's rightful place and this is where they belong. And it didn't have any economic value to it. And I think she posits a good question to say like, okay, hey, this is something that should be worth considering of, which also leads into, I suppose, the ability for a woman to provide value. Because is it only able to be done in this kind of like non-economic form? This isn't a large portion of the book. It's, you know, it's very fragmented, this book. It's all over the shop. Even though there's 6 chapters, like the chapters, they don't really stay consistent. They kind of meander everywhere. And I'll talk more about the style in the extra portion towards the end. So she starts positing this, and then she also is talking about, okay, like, why aren't we seeing many women in literature and fiction? What she was essentially saying, the argument was, you need a room of one's own, hence the title of the book. And the predominant way that women were, I suppose, living in not only her era, but basically all eras before that, was they never got time for themselves. They were always part of a family. There was always interruptions coming through. They were always expected to, you know, if the men were in the drawing room by the fire, sitting or smoking or chatting or something, she would be nearby. And they never really got a room to sit down and to concentrate, and if they were to write, you know, dedicatedly without interruption. So what she essentially says along with this is you to be able to do that, you kind of need like a salary. You need to be able to economically support yourself. So she was saying, you know, one of the reasons, well, perhaps the main reason, you don't see much women in fiction and literature up until this point in history, 1928, 1929, was that they didn't have a room of one's own and £500 a year of money, which in today's terms, in Australian dollars, I looked this up and it was about 15,000 Australian. So, you know, kind of just enough to survive on. You know, you'd be able to find a place and to buy food, but you certainly wouldn't be like living large or anything like this. And I think there's a reasonable theory that good writing requires this, because if you were to try and write like, you know, a masterpiece, it's you're not likely to do it if you are constantly being distracted by children or by expectations of society, or you have to go out and do this and do that. And the kind of, I suppose what she really does with these arguments, these rational arguments, is kind of paint a picture of what times were like. And it's like, okay, you know, put yourself in these shoes. Would you be able to create a masterpiece like Shakespeare or something like Milton wrote or something like this? And the outcome from these kind of like logical deductions is like, no, okay, probably not. You probably wouldn't be able to do this. So she does back this up with historical examples of women writers, and not only of the conditions they were living in, but the kind of stigma that came along with this and being mocked. She had this realistic hypothetical of imagine Judith Shakespeare, you know, Shakespeare's sister. Would she have been able, and supposing she had the same intellect as him, would she have been able to create this, you know, the masterpieces that he did? And if you go through like Shakespeare's life or the opportunities that he had of, you know, working in a theater and doing all of these things, it'd be like, nope, she wouldn't be able to do that. Nope, she wouldn't be able to support herself. Nope, she wouldn't be able to, you know, people would kick her out. People would do this. And so, you know, whilst it's not strictly like backed up by numbers and stats and statistics and things like this, I think she makes some pretty coherent arguments of like, okay, women have had a pretty rough go of it in the sense of being able to pursue objects, passions, things that they're interested in. And part of this was due to stigma, society, expectations, no, like a woman writing, that's the, you know, how ridiculous. And then also just some straight hard kind of facts about the conditions they were living in. This gets us, I suppose, into the next section, which was arguing more with emotion rather than pure reason. But she's in the right as well. There's definitely arguments she makes where you go, yeah, you know, it's an emotional argument, but I think she's right as well. This is so the first section, I'd say, comprised about like one third of the book in total. This section as well, I'd say, is about one third of it. And, you know, many of the comments made about women are rather absurd. And here's a list of quotes that rather famous people have said about women and creative arts, such as writing, performing, composing, etc. I don't have attributions for all of these people because it's kind of pointless, but here's some things that people who are well-known and respected during, you know, the period of time before 1929 had said about women. So publicity in women is detestable, i.e. a woman being famous in and of itself is like a gross thing. It's impossible for any woman, past or present, to have the genius of Shakespeare. So claims upon their actual intellectual abilities. This is a quote. Sir, a woman's composing is like a dog's walking on his hind legs. It is not done well, but you are surprised to find it done at all. So this is someone just like coming out and straight up saying like a woman's composing, and this is, you know, composing music. It's so shoddy, but, you know, you're surprised that they even have the capability to even attempt such a feat. So this is not the only quote attributed to dogs as well. The essentials of a woman's being are that they are supported by and they minister to men. So very much just being like, you know, a woman's place is to look after the man, and they're very much subservient to him. A woman acting put him in the mind of a dog's dancing. So this is related to acting abilities, once again, on the stage and things like this. And this is my favorite quote because this is just like the most absurd thing. And this was from a lecturer who had women in his college, as, along with men as well. And so he's kind of like marking grades. And he says, irrespective of the marks he might give, the best woman was intellectually the inferior of the worst man. And this is where it's just like, okay, you're a professor. The whole point of education and this sort of system in colleges, universities, is to be able to do it meritocratically. You know, who is smarter? Who knows the most knowledge? Who can logically, you know, deduct things or create the best pieces of work or whatever it is? And you know, that's the whole point of it. And then he goes to says, like, irrespective if, like, a woman does better than a man, she's still beneath him. It's just like, wow. Wow. So that's like the most hamsterizing in the brain, absurd logical thinking you can imagine. So you get a taste there of like, okay, there's definitely, this was a time period where if you wanted to break out and try and write something of your own, write a book, it's going to be hard. It's not going to be easy. And this is where we come into the last section. And once again, not sectioned in terms of the book, but just in terms of the overall things and topics she was touching upon. Turns into an analysis of women writers like Jane Austen, Emily Bronte, who she thinks wrote like women without anger. So she was saying, okay, they were writing in their most womanly voice possible. And we'll touch more on that in a second. And then we also have her analysis of people like George Eliot, like who was the other, Charlotte Bronte, so the sister, you know, of Emily Bronte. And she is kind of like describing these women and saying like, I don't think they wrote that well. I don't think these girls are that great writers. They're good writers, but they kind of wrote like men. They had this bitterness about them. And you can imagine the anger and bitterness of all of these expectations of, you know, you want to pursue something and then you've got a man saying like, oh, intellectually you're inferior to like the worst of the men. And it's like, well, okay, well, that's, have you seen this dude over here? Like, he's an imbecile. and so, you know, the problem with this whole section that she gets into here is she doesn't exactly describe what it is to write like a woman. She just says they don't do it well, these other ones do it well, but she doesn't describe what exactly it is within the word. She doesn't point out quotes which show like, okay, this is the point where she started writing like a man. And it seems unnecessarily harsh in her criticism of there was a first-time author that she picked out named Mary Carmichael. From what I can tell, a complete nobody who maybe wrote one piece of work, just this one book or perhaps many others, but is certainly kind of like a little bit lost to history. And she just tears this girl apart. It's like really unnecessary of saying, you know, this girl is, she writes like she starts off good. I thought it was going to be great. And then like, it just turns into trash. And, you know, this is me adding stuff in. She wasn't this harsh, but the overall feeling I got from it was she's just being really mean for no real reason. You know, the irony of a female author, you know, trying to expand upon women in fiction, I suppose, like, it's more of an encouraging piece, like saying, like, this is how it should be done or this is how it can be done. And yet tearing apart a first-time author is the irony of it. It seems a little bit, seems a little strange to me. And this, I guess, gets into another trend, not particularly related to just this book, but I believe she was a book critic as well, not a book reviewer, but a book critic. And they try themselves to be rather witty. And I think a lot of this wittiness comes through as scorn and biting attacks. If you're a critic of books, you know, critiquing, it definitely has this criticism. It has this idea of this kind of negativity behind it rather than a necessarily positive type of thing. And, you know, when I just take some of these sections overall, there is a couple of iffy things she says. You know, she was talking about women should have the right to work as like coal heavers and 100-hour weeks in finance and bankers and things like this. And I think they should have the right to do it, but do they actually do it? And this is where I think she was saying, you know, one of the reasons women are subjugated, poor, is because they they would do all of these things that men would do. And I think this is, well, the data and statistics don't indicate this. You know, in the mining industry, it's like 95% guys. This is where I used to work. And women have the access. They kind of get like favored promotion. And they get favored. If you're a woman, that's like a really, really good thing, because they want to try and have more diversity and whatever in the mining industry. But still, women just don't go there, even though the pay is good. And it's like, oh, okay. They're just not necessarily that drawn into like engineering. It's a boring like mathematical thing. Like I think they do well to stay away from it. Same thing, like 100-hour weeks in finance. Like, are you sure you want to do that? I think they make the smart decision not to. So there was just a couple of things in there where I think she was throwing out assumptions that, you know, the way the world is due only to the she doesn't say the patriarchy, but definitely the overall idea that women can't do these things just because men stop them from doing it. And I don't think it's exactly that. I think there's some other reasonings behind that related to how the brains work. And she notices there's differences between men and women at the same time. So there's a couple of points where we get to contradictions. Anyway, let's jump on to Virginia Woolf herself. So she led an interesting life, to say the least. She was rather independent in many different ways, and she was part of this intellectual group called the Bloomsbury Group, and this was in England in, you know, the early 1900s. She ended up marrying a guy, someone Woolf. I can't remember his name, so she had a different last name before she met him. And wrote many books, wrote many essays. It's kind of hard to tell exactly how popular she was back then. It seemed like she had some success in her productive years of actually writing. So I think this was in the 1920s and 1930s. But then, you know, she ended up having a lot of mental issues, killed herself in an awful, terrible way of putting stones in her pocket and in an overcoat, and then drowning herself by walking into a river. And she was battling with mental issues and decided suicide was the only way out for her and for her husband. And then there was a big gap until the 1970s, and then where I'm not sure she was popular. It's kind of hard to tell. I didn't live then. It was almost 100 years ago, this sort of stuff. Where in the 1970s, the feminist movement picked her up again. It was like, look at this woman author. She's making really great points. And then started deconstructing and analyzing her literature, all of these sorts of things. So, interesting life to say the least. And I think she's got more famous novels, but this is probably the most well-known of her essays, and which once again was, normally I'm not a fan of people taking, what would you call it? Talks or conversations or dialogues and then converting that to book form. I usually find it doesn't work well. Lots of Buddhist literature does this. I've read many book on this channel which does this, and I think there's only been like one or two which I find okay. This is a weird one because it didn't feel like it was a talk necessarily, even though she was saying at many points like directing it as if it was to an audience. And I think this is because her style itself is this stream of consciousness. And I'm not a fan of it. I'm not a fan of stream of consciousness books. Many of the Latin American boom period, Carlos Fuentes, people like that employ this style. And it's always come across as too rambly for my thoughts. If I wanted kind of a disconnected, incoherent thoughts, I'll just listen to my own brain for a while and follow my own mind, do a little bit of meditation, and go like, oh, Jesus, like this place is going everywhere. And this is what her book was like. It was all over the shop. There was no clear pattern or clear path for each of these chapters. She touched upon many different things. You think she's circling around, and then she goes through the loop instead and comes out with a, you know, it's like a roller coaster. And so, you know, there was just all these theories. You said, you know, there exists a manly and a womanly soul in each of us, and that it's not useful to view the sexes as distinct, and that the best writing is androgynous, and that we err on one side or the other as men or women, and that a couple is the perfect blend, that's the perfect matrimony, all of which will contradict what she said earlier. It's very, I don't know, perhaps this is just my man womanly brain. Slash soul taking over too much, who knows, but I'm just not a fan of that style at all. So let's jump into this last section here, my summary, similar recommendations, things like this. I can see why the feminist movement really frothed over her. She made valid points about the unfair disparity between men and women, about why not only just in literature but across many different genres women had a like an unfair go of it. And a lot of this was due to prejudice and, you know, social norms at the time, which have since evaporated, you know, here almost 100 years later. Maybe there's still some existing, but I think it's definitely more an, how do you say it? Egalitarian? It's more equal society now. What I didn't like was the vague, incoherent enough that you could endlessly interpret whatever she said to put your own spin on things. That portion of the book I didn't like. And I can see why the feminist, you know, movement literature would have really liked it, because you could endlessly analyze this thing, each, you know, paragraphs that she says, and, you know, what does she actually mean there? What does this mean for women? Because earlier in the book she says something different, or it's like, it's kind of like vague, you know. So I can see why people would like this, but yeah, the rational arguments, it seems to just, the vagueness just seems to leave itself for debates, arguments, controversy. It's not for me. It's not for me. So whilst she made a couple of good points, overall, I got to say the book is not one of my favorites. So I'm going to give this book, Virginia Woolf's A Room of One's Own, I don't know, 3.5 out of 10. I can't really advocate for it and say, like, damn, this is the best, you know, like, piece of literature I've ever read. So I can't say I've read anything similar before myself personally either. So I don't really know what to recommend here. She had quite a few, you know, she was talking about Jane Austen, Pride and Prejudice. She talked about Wuthering Heights. Of the books she's mentioned, Wuthering Heights is the only one I've actually read before. And I think that's a pretty solid book. I enjoyed reading it. I can't remember what I rated it and reviewed it, because it was before I was doing this book review channel, but I think it was pretty good. So, you know, go read some of the, you know, the classic female authors and see if you can notice there being a womanly voice or a womanly voice which is tinged with anger and has too much man in it. Yeah, I'll be interested if you could find that out yourself. Last section here, or second last, is I'll leave the obvious hypocritical question of, you know, I was kind of complaining about book critiquing before, and yet here I am critiquing books, although I think there is a difference. I think I do book reviews rather than book critiques. So we'll leave that for another time. That'll be a filler episode where I'll talk about the differences between those two. So this is a Value for Value podcast, and I do actually want to shout out someone, TJ from last week. So TJ the Wrathful sent in a boostergram. So this is a message you can send directly within a podcasting app to help monetarily support the show. And TJ said, loving all you do for V4V. 3,333 sats sent using Podcast Guru. So in Australian dollars, that's probably about like $3.50. Very much appreciated. Thank you. Thank you. And you send that through Podcast Guru. So if you want to support the show in a monetary form as well, you could do that through a podcasting app, meremortalspodcast.com/support. I've got a bunch of links there, and as well an explanation of why you would want to do that and how you can do that. And then there is also a PayPal link down below in the show notes, which you could also click as well, which I would very much appreciate if you send through something there as well. So, you know, you can also value for value. You can return value in many different ways. I'd recommend sharing the episode with a fellow book lover, perhaps someone who is perhaps doing an essay or writing upon these types of things, you know, all these sorts of things, as well as book recommendations for myself of, you know, if I didn't like this, what other types of feminist literature might I enjoy based on, you know, the reasons why I didn't like it, things like this. So would very much appreciate that. I am live here. I do these 10 a.m. Australian Eastern Standard Time on a Thursday. So if you ever feel like joining me live, like my co-host Juan is here, and he said, I have read one prior. I can't quite recall the name of it, but it had feminist in the title. Found it particularly informative about the difficulties in aging populations more than anything else. Okay. And yeah, certainly different. We don't critique. We aren't informed enough to make such calls, but we can review from our own viewpoint. I think the main thing of a critique is they generally say what they think the writer should have said. And I rarely, rarely ever do that because I you know, they're their own person, and I feel like I should respect the decisions and paths they chose to go down. Whereas critiquing usually does have this element of like, they should have said this, or they could have said this, or something like that, which I'm not a fan of. So anyway, you can join in live, right in the chat as well. And I usually stick around for a while afterwards if you feel like hanging out. What's coming up next? We have The Innocents Abroad by Mark Twain. I am going to get that done for this next book. And then one more after that. I'm not sure exactly what it'll be. It'll be a rather small one because I'll be going to Brazil pretty soon afterwards. So I think it's something like Sir Gawain and the Green Knight, or I might do Rip Van Winkle and something like that. It'll be a short story. And then we'll have Juan for a while, which will be interesting. So we'll have some pre-recorded episodes while I'm kind of traveling around Brazil. Probably the first couple of weeks there, I'm going to be all over the shop. So we'll have some pre-recorded ones from Juan, which will be awesome. And then I'll try and get back into the swing of things. So that is it for today. Thank you very much for joining me. A bit of a shorter one compared to normal. Or perhaps I have been talking for a while, so maybe it isn't that short. but very much appreciated for tuning in, listening in, joining. And I really do hope you're having a fantastic day wherever you are in the world. Ciao for now. Kyren out.